Good evening, everyone. And thank you so much, Joseph, for joining us here. These are difficult times, and at the same time, these are times that we feel, I think, as practitioners, the power and the real support of this practice and the Dharma. And this special evening is a very important evening for us here in Israel because of the translation of this wonderful book. So I'd like to start with a few words in Hebrew. I was asked to talk about the organizers of this meeting. So I'm sorry for moving into Hebrew for a few minutes, but then the evening will be in English. And we'll have Uri, the translator of the book. We'll talk a little bit, and then we'll hear Joseph in a Dharma talk, and we'll have times for questions and answers. Okay, so I'm gonna read from my list of things that I was asked to say. This evening is organized by Tovana and Buddhism Beisrael. So I'm going to move into Hebrew. I hope I'm going to be able to read from my computer. I'm not sure. Let's see. Yeah. אז בחודשים האחרונים עמותת תובנה מציעה מפגשי אונליין עם מורות ומורי דרמה מהארץ ומעולם כדי להיפגש כסנגה ולתמוך ביציבות ובתרגול בזמנים של קושי. המפגשים מתקיימים ללא דמי הרשמה וללא עלות. אתם מוזמנים לתמוך בתובנה דרך אתר תובנה. עמותת תובנה פועלת קרוב ל-30 שנים לארגון מסגרות לימוד דרמה ולתמיכה בתרגול של מדיטציה תובנה. לעמותה יש מרכז ריטריטים בקיבוץ עין דור, בו מתקיימים ריטריטים עם מורים מהארץ ומחו"ל. בני 3 ימים עד 3 שבועות, ומרכז עירוני בתל אביב, שבו מתקיימים קורסים ומפגשים יומיים, המיועדים לתמוך בתרגול בחיי היומיום ולהרחיבו. בנוסף, יש פעילות ענפה באונליין, שפה אנחנו בפעילות שכזו, וכן ימי תרגול וקבוצות ישיבה ברחבי הארץ וכל הפרטים באתר. הארגון השני שנתן חסות לערב הזה הוא בודהיזם בישראל, שהוקם בשנת 2007 על ידי אבי פאר ואילן לוטנברג, הוא האתר שמציג היום את הספרייה הגדולה בישראל של מאמרים מתורגמים של בכירי מורי המורים הבודהיסטים בעולם, ביניהם כמובן ג'וזף. בהוצאת הספרים של בודהיזם בישראל יש כיום כ-25 כותרים מתורגמים חשובים מעולם הדרמה, ובחנות הספרים שבאתר, שבה תוכלו לרכוש את הספר שלשמו התכנסנו כאן הערב, בהנחה עם קופון מיוחד, ירוכזו כל הספרים העוסקים בנושאים בודהיסטיים בישראל. Okay, so that was our Hebrew part of this evening, and now I'm very, very happy to introduce Uri Mishol, the translator of this book, and if I may say so, I think he did a wonderful job. Uri is a dedicated practitioner as well as an entrepreneur in the fields of high tech, education, and peacemaking. Uri lives in Jaffa with his wife, 3 children, and 2 cats, where he also leads a local sangha. This is his first venture in a book translation. So, Uri, to you.
Thanks, Nati. Can everybody hear me okay? Good. So I'd just like to say it's so moving to see so many people joining here to listen to Joseph and also to celebrate the book's release in Hebrew, and also Joseph to have you as our guest. And like Matty said, these are tough times. And I think 2 years ago when I started translating the book, I couldn't imagine that it would come out in times like these. But I guess sometimes the aspects of unreliability and unsatisfactoriness just so painfully clear. And is just a time like that. So we actually thought whether it's a good idea to release the book or wait a bit, but we felt it could actually offer some comfort and guidance. And I remember, Joseph, when we were nearing the end of the translation, I asked you to write if you could write a short paragraph to add to the book's introduction. And you ended that paragraph saying that the world is in great need of greater wisdom and compassion. And this was before October 7th, and I think these words ring even more true today. So this is also a celebration, and I think there's also value in that as well, a celebration for the Sangha, for the Dharma community here. And it was actually, I think Matthew didn't mention that, but Karen wasn't feeling well enough to join us. So Karen, I hope you're hearing this and you'll feel better soon. And I was actually looking forward to listen to Karen talk about Joseph and the book, but I'll have to settle for listening to myself in this case. Apologies, this is somewhat unprepared. But I think for a lot of the participants here, Joseph needs no introduction. But I know it's been, I think, something like 10 years, Joseph, since you last taught in Israel. So for those of you who weren't here, I'll say a few words about Joseph, if that's okay. So Joseph is really one of the first Western teachers to have come back from the East during the 70s after studying for several years with really some of the most renowned teachers of that time, teachers like Anagarika Munindra and Saida Upandita and Dipa Ma. And I think pretty much ever since he's been teaching and leading insight and metta meditation retreats. And he's really considered to be one of the most influential Western Dharma teachers in the insight tradition. And Joseph is the co-founder of IMS, Insight Meditation Society, which is one of the biggest retreat centers in the United States. And I think actually are very, this was a model when starting our own Tovana Center in Indore. So this was sort of a model to build on and according to which we still practice here. And Joseph also authored several books, and my favorite is Mindfulness, a Practical Guide for Awakening. And I think it's one of those rare occasions when a book with a big name really stands up, you know, to the name. I remember I talked when I started the translation process. I remember speaking with a jazz musician friend of mine, and I told him about the book's title, and he actually laughed and told me that the book that taught him the most was a book called Learn How to Improvise. You know, so it's just one of those rare occasions when such a name re really fulfills itself. And I think I came across the book about a year after its release. And I think back then I probably had a meditation retreat or two behind me, and maybe took a course or two about Buddhism. And I was absolutely blown away by the clarity and the deepness, and it validated some of my experiences. And I think probably more than everything, it showed me how deep this rabbit hole could go, and how integrated and well mapped the practice path is. So translating it and even celebrating today is sort of a closing circle in a way. So yeah, I think what's so special about the book is that, and I don't know if that's your feeling, Joseph, but For me, it's really evident that it packs more than 40 years of experience in teaching and all the wisdom gained during that process in such a clear and practical way. So this is at least my feeling for this special book. I'd like to maybe say a few notes about the translation process into Hebrew. So this is a very comprehensive book on both the practice, on the Dharma, and it was a very nuanced task to translate into Hebrew. And sometimes there were very, very subtle dilemmas that came up, and we found ourselves needing to dance between the not only between the English and the Hebrew, but sometimes also going to the Pali source. So I was incredibly lucky to have Keren Arbel with me as scientific editor. And it was such a joy to work together on all these wonderful little dilemmas that came up. And on top of that, we had a Supreme Court of Justice to turn to when that was necessary, in the form of Joseph, who was there to clarify and even change sometimes the wording when we felt it was necessary. So maybe just to give one example of such a dilemma, I think even translating the book's name, mindfulness, is far from trivial to translate it into Hebrew. So there are a few possibilities in Hebrew, like words like muda'ut and kshivut that came up. And even the word mindfulness is actually an approximation. I think a wonderful one, but an approximation from the Pali word sati. We eventually decided to keep the English word as the book title, also because it's so closely associated with the book, but also because of the very important line it draws between modern mindfulness practice and the Dharma. But we also use, I think even mostly used, the beautiful phrase we have in Hebrew for mindfulness, which is tsumet lev, which literally means placing one's heart into something or onto something. And I think this is really such a wonderful description of mindfulness. You know, it's literally meditative instructions packed into two words. And I think it's so ironic that we use it so often without paying attention to its deeper meaning, you know, without lesim lev. So mindfulness is the book title, Mindfulness Madrich Ma'asi Leitorerut, but it's used interchangeably with tsumet lev throughout the book. And there were many other similar dilemmas. We also recorded some of the thinking process that we thought would be helpful or useful, and that's found in footnotes we added to the Hebrew version. So I hope these are useful also for you. Maybe one last note is just to say that I think it's impossible to translate this kind of book as a practitioner without it impacting your practice. So, and I feel the translation process has touched me in a deeper way than I could imagine when I started. So if there's anyone in the audience considering translating as a practice, I think there are one or two English Dharma books that haven't yet been translated into Hebrew. So I really encourage that. I'll also say that the book is on sale in Akibbutz HaMeuchad's website and also on Buddhism Israel's website, where there's also a special discount coupon. Again, thank you so much, Keren, for being part of this journey. Thank you, Joseph, for this wonderful book. And also thank you, Matti. Last formality for the evening. Matti has agreed to host this evening, and she's a wonderful teacher, as well as the co-founder and director of professional trainings in the Center for Compassionate Mindful Education. And she also wrote two best-selling books about mindfulness and is a dedicated Dharma practitioner and teacher. So Thank you, Matti, and thanks everyone for joining.
I think I was I forgot to say a few things, so I'll just say a few things about this evening. We will hear Dharma talk right now from Joseph, but we did ask you to send us questions ahead, and we have wonderful questions after the Dharma talk. And if you do have questions while you're listening, you can write them in the chat, and I will do my best to try to read them and see what we can answer. So, thank you. So you're on mute. You need, okay. Raoult, are you here? Can you unmute Joseph, please? It's a silent retreat Dharma talk. Here, great.
Well, thanks to all of you, and especially to Yuri, both for that wonderful introduction, but even more importantly, for the immense amount of work that went into the translation of this book. As you may have heard, he spent 2 years in this undertaking, so not a simple matter. So a lot of appreciation, Yuri, for the immense amount of work you did in this project. So, given the tremendous challenges that are facing Israel and actually so many other places in the world today, I wanted to speak briefly about the role mindfulness can play in navigating just all the complexities of these situations, which, as you all know very well, is not an easy task at all. It's really a very complex and difficult time. So the most basic premise of all the Buddhist teachings is that we need to take responsibility for our own minds. And a lot of people don't realize this. You know, we may be blaming outside circumstances for how we're feeling and not really understand that we can take responsibility for our own mind states and our actions. And the essential first step in taking responsibility for our minds, for our hearts, is the practice of mindfulness. So the first question really for us to consider is what mindfulness actually means, because there are many nuances in the understanding of it that are sometimes overlooked in its very widespread usage in these times. I'm not sure how it is in Israel, but in the States, mindfulness has become part of the mainstream. But it's not necessarily with an understanding of its deeper implications. So this evening, I'd just like to highlight a few of the nuances of what mindfulness is and what it isn't. So, if somebody were to ask us the question, well, what is mindfulness? I think a very common response would be, well, it's living in the present moment. Right? If we're constantly lost in the daydream of our thoughts, it's very difficult to find any clarity or balance. So living in the present is really an essential foundation for any understanding of our minds and of our lives. But although this present moment awareness is foundational, it's actually not enough. It does not really encompass the deeper meanings of mindfulness. So just as an example, think of a small puppy, you know, full of energy, you know, engaged, running around, completely involved in the momentary and ever-changing sense experiences. And we can get very engaged and enjoy kind of the antics of a young puppy living its life. But as we look, you know, and we're watching the puppy, which is living in the present moment, right? It's not in the past, it's not in the future, but it doesn't really seem to be very mindful, right? As it's going on living its puppy life. And so it gives us an indication that yes, living in the present is essential, but it's not sufficient. If we really want to understand the deeper meaning of mindfulness, we have to explore something in addition to simply living in the present moment. So a further aspect that we can look at and investigate is what we might call the observing power of the mind. And by that I mean that as we're observing, we are aware that we're knowing. So it's not simply bare perception like the puppy. When we're in the observing mode of mind, we're aware of what's present, and we know that we're aware. So this is an important distinction. It's the difference, for example, between being lost in a thought, as often happens, and being aware that we're thinking. So it's helpful to keep this distinction in mind. And this observing power of the mind, when we're observing what happens and we know that we're being aware, it opens up very interesting new possibilities of investigation, and one that can really transform the way we're living our lives and our way of being in the world. So as most of you know who have done any meditation practice, normally we go through the day with a steady stream of unnoticed thoughts. Right, this thought process, it's almost, somebody once described the mind as a thought machine, you know, and anybody who's observed their minds at all will know how prevalent this thought process is in our lives. What's interesting, even among practitioners of many years, just in the course of our daily lives, so often there's this stream of thoughts going on, background thoughts, and we're not really aware that they're there. This is very impactful. It's something like the soundtrack of a movie. You know, when you go to the movies, we can get really caught up and interested and engaged in the story, and perhaps are hardly aware excuse me, of the background music, the soundtrack. And yet, that background music is actually manipulating and conditioning how we feel. As we're immersed in the story, the music conditions, you know, whether we're tense or excited or we're sad, you know, or we're peaceful or we're joyous. All of this is being conditioned by this soundtrack that we may not even have been aware of. So the stream of thoughts in our mind during the day is like the soundtrack of our lives. These thoughts, often and even mostly unnoticed, are having an impact on our minds, our emotions. They are conditioning how we feel, and they are conditioning the kinds of actions we take based on those feelings. You know, so all of these thoughts that are going on unnoticed, they are conditioning or creating the inner environment in which we're living and out of which we're acting. So here's where the observing power of mind can play such a critical role. First, we become more aware of the particular kinds of thoughts that are arising. We are paying attention to the content of what the thoughts are saying. So we may begin to notice, and again, for those of you who have been practicing mindfulness, you'll be very familiar with this. We become more aware of thoughts of past and thoughts of future, or family thoughts, or work thoughts, or thoughts are just about the world situation or the local situation. So this is the content of what the thoughts are saying. So this is important because this is a first step leading towards mindfulness, where we're aware that we're thinking rather than being lost in them and simply carried away unknowingly. So this observing power of mind, the first part of it, begins to open up much greater awareness of our thought process. But then there is a second transformative understanding that can come with regard to the stream of thoughts. And this is something that I have found both completely interesting and also hugely impactful. And it has to do with us asking the question of ourselves as we're thinking. You know, for example, if you're sitting and meditating or just walking and you're being aware of thoughts going on in the mind, in addition to understanding what the thought is saying, we can begin to ask a question that very few people ever ask in their lives. And the question is, what is a thought? Not what is the thought saying, but what is a thought as a phenomenon? So this is a very different approach to understanding the thought process. We're going from the content, from the storyline, to the nature of thought as a phenomenon in the mind. And when we do this, you know, so we're sitting, thoughts are arising, and then if one remembers, oh, well, what is a thought? And we actually look directly at the nature of thought, we see something remarkable. We see that a thought is little more than nothing. It is like this little wisp of energy in the mind, that's all. When we're looking directly at it, again, not what it's saying, but just the nature of it, it's so ephemeral and so insubstantial and so empty. But what's so amazing is that, and this is really one of the great paradoxes of our lives, when we're unaware that we're thinking, thoughts have tremendous power in our lives. They are like little dictators of the mind. Right, thoughts are arising. Go here, go there, do this, do that. You know, the thoughts are coming, and then we just act on them without much awareness of the whole process. The beauty of seeing repeatedly, and I would encourage you to do this in your meditation practice, but also throughout the day, to just look and see repeatedly into the empty, insubstantial nature of thought, of seeing it as just this little energy blip arising and passing in the mind. The more we see that, the more we understand this nature of thought, it gives us the capacity to choose wisely. We can see those thoughts which are coming, which are helpful, which are useful, and so then we act on them in one way or another. But when we see the many, many thoughts that are not helpful, that are not useful, understanding the empty nature of thought actually allows us to just let it come, let it go, without it impacting us. So this gives tremendous space in the mind for wise discernment. Wise discernment not only about what we're thinking, but wise discernment about what we do based on our thoughts. So this is really essential, I think, to living with wisdom, you know, and to living with greater compassion and love. But this observing power of mind, which is a big step forward from the puppy mind, you know, of just bare perception, we go to this observing power of mind, which I just described. But it's still not, or is often not yet mindfulness. And this begins to indicate the depth of what mindfulness actually means. Because we can be observing anything, could be observing our thoughts, our emotions, our bodies, the world outside. We can actually be observing and knowing, you know, that we're seeing or thinking or feeling, but the observing can be happening through various and often unnoticed filters. That is, we're observing what's arising very often through the filter of wanting, through the filter of aversion, through the filter of delusion. And so our perception of what's arising gets distorted by these filters in the mind that we may not be conscious of. So one teacher described these three ways of relating, you know, of wanting or aversion and delusion. This teacher described it as the mind that is pulling something in, which is wanting, pushing away, which is aversion, and running around in circles, which is delusion. And so I just like that kind of very vivid imagery, you know, describing these various attitudes of the mind. So I'd like to give just a couple of examples of how these filters are often conditioning our experience unknowingly. So this goes back to the time I was practicing in Burma with my teacher Sayadaw Upandita. And he was a very demanding teacher. So in a way, he was like a fierce Zen master. So the retreats were very intense. And he had very high standards of practice. I had been at the monastery for a couple of months, and my practice had settled in, and it was feeling pretty good. You know, the body felt open, just kind of a free flow of energy, and the what I thought was mindfulness seemed to be flowing along very smoothly. But in this very open field of quite smooth energy, there was one place in my neck that felt like an energetic block. You know, and so I would be watching it and trying to release the block. I go in for my meeting with Sai Dao, and I'm giving my report on my meditation, and I describe all this to him, and I say, but there's this one block, you know, in my body. And he just looked at me, and he got on my case for calling it a block. And this was something I hadn't even realized, but just describing it that way to myself and relating to it as a block already contained aversion in that way of relating. And I thought I was just describing an objective situation, not realizing, oh, block, that means I have to do something to get rid of the block. So right there, aversion is at play. And it was so interesting having that pointed out. And it's really a good lesson in how the language we use to describe what's happening conditions how we're relating to what's happening. And so this is a really helpful thing to begin to understand, you know, in our lives, in our practice. This awareness of these filters in the mind through which we are observing our experience, it plays a very critical role in navigating the powerful realm of emotions. You know, and I'm sure given the current hugely challenging situation going on now, there must be powerful emotions arising at different times. Here's where it's really important to begin to see whether we're observing the emotions that we're feeling through a filter or not. So I'll share another story from my own practice, and this goes back years, but it was really quite transformative for me. So many years, it's maybe 20, 30 years ago in my practice, the strongest emotion that was coming up for me, and over a long period of time, was, in a way, it was the most deeply conditioned, afflictive emotion, you know, that would be arising, was the emotion of fear. And it wasn't even fear about anything in particular. It was just, it was like the primal energy of fear. For whatever reason, it was just showing itself over and over again, over a long period of time, over years in my practice. And it was so intense. There were times when I would be sitting and I would feel fear to stand. It was completely irrational. It didn't make any sense at all. And yet the emotion was just, for whatever reason, it was manifesting. So I recognized it and I was noting, you know, fear, fear, fear. But it still kept coming a lot. It still felt very lodged in my being. Then one time, and again, it was when Saito Pandita was teaching here in the States, I was doing walking meditation and this fear was coming up and something shifted. And the shift was expressed in the phrase, if this fear is here for the rest of my life, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay to feel it. And that was the first moment in all of these years of practicing with it, it was the first moment that I truly accepted it. And that was revelatory to me. It was so interesting. And in that moment of genuine acceptance, it's okay, just let me feel it. When I could see it without the filter of wanting it to go away, which I did because it's an unpleasant emotion, right? Didn't like it and did want it to go away. But when I could see it without that filter, oh, it's okay to feel this even though it's unpleasant, that whole mass of fear washed through. It's not to say fear never arises again, but my relationship to it is completely different. It's like not being stuck in it, not being caught by it. So this experience highlights the important distinction in our understanding of our mindfulness practice between recognition and mindfulness, because we often confuse the two. We often think that if we're recognizing what's there, it means that we're being mindful. But we can recognize what's there, as I had been doing with the fear. I knew what it was. I recognized it, but I was not accepting it. So mindfulness is not simply recognition. It's not simply the observing power of mind. And here's where we're getting to the real heart of what mindfulness means. We're with what's arising, whether pleasant or unpleasant, or even very unpleasant. Mindfulness means being what's arising without wanting, without pulling it in, without pushing away, and without just getting lost in confused thoughts about it all. So this would be something really helpful to keep an eye out for, you know, in your practice. In doing this, one important indication of non-acceptance, because sometimes we're not even aware that we're not accepting it. So one important kind of signal to us that something's going on that we're not accepting is a sense of struggle. Yeah, we're all familiar, both in our meditation practice and in our lives. We're all familiar with what it feels like when there's a kind of inner struggle going on. Well, struggle, this feeling of struggle, can be a very useful feedback, because what it's really telling us is that something is going on. It may be, you know, strong physical sensations in the body, or challenging emotions or situations in the world. When there's a sense of struggle, it's telling us that something is arising in our experience that we're not accepting. Because if we were accepting of it, we wouldn't be struggling. So again, we can turn what might seem to be a problem, you know, and with reference now to the meditation practice itself, you know, when we're struggling in our meditation in one way or another, we might think, oh, you know, this is a problem. We can transform that into taking that struggle as a sign to us. You know, oh, what's going on here that I'm not open to, that I'm not accepting? And so it actually deepens our practice. But there's a very essential point here as we're speaking about acceptance. It's important to recognize that acceptance does not mean non-responsiveness. Right? Acceptance actually provides the balance and clarity in seeing a situation so that we can respond skillfully. So it's, in a way, it's understanding the difference between responding and reacting, or responsiveness and reactivity. When we're simply reacting to the situations within ourselves or in the world, basically we're simply just acting out our own particular habit patterns of conditioning, right? And it may involve, you know, wanting this or that, or aversion to this or that, not necessarily having clarity, having balance, having a deep understanding of what an appropriate response should be. So in our growing understanding of mindfulness, of what it means, we go from the bare perception of puppy consciousness, you know, just running around, engaged in the world, but without any awareness of what's being observed. So we go from that to the observing power of mind, where we do recognize what it is that's there. We investigate the content of our thoughts, and we investigate the very nature of thought. And we begin to then see or examine or investigate, are there filters going on in the mind that is obscuring a really mindful relationship to them? Because it's only when we're really mindful, when there is that quality of openness, of spaciousness of mind, of clarity, of balance, of non-reactivity, that actually allows us to see things clearly. And it's interesting, the term Vipassana, which is often translated as insight meditation, the Pali word, as I understand it, and I'm not a Pali scholar, but this is how my teacher Munindraji explained it to me. He said the literal meaning of Vipassana is to see clearly, or to see things from all sides. So we could say that our mindfulness practice, you know, as it develops into insight, comes or results in this clear seeing. So the last thing I just want to mention, a few simple tools that we can use in our practice and in our lives, just in our daily life experience, to know whether we are actually being mindful in this deepest meaning that I've been talking about, or we've slipped back unknowingly into a mind of reactivity. And sometimes that reactivity can be very obvious, and sometimes it can be really subtle. So there are just two ways that I found really effective in helping to notice, you know, whether the mind is being reactive or whether it's being mindful. So one is really simple. And in your practice, one of the tools, you know, in mindfulness meditation, in some traditions, not all of the teachers teach in this way, but many of my teachers did, it was using the tool of mental noting, mental labeling. You know, so it can be really simple. We're just acknowledging And this is the recognition part, you know, in, out, or thinking, or hearing, or seeing. So we're making just a very soft, gentle note, which helps keep us on track. So one way of determining whether we're actually being mindful or we're being reactive is to notice the tone of the note in the mind, right? So for example, if you've just been lost in thoughts a lot, and then you start noting, but you're noting with a kind of aversive tone. Oh, thinking, 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 you know, where the tone is embodying some kind of self-judgment. So the tone is going to reveal to us, oh, the mind is not being mindful at this moment, even though it's recognizing the thoughts are there, because we're relating to it with aversion. And what's really amazing is that simply by changing the tone of voice of the note in the mind, you know, from a maybe judgmental tone or aversive tone, we just soften it. Oh, thinking, thinking. Just by changing the tone of voice of the note, it changes the quality of our minds. And so if in your practice you do use the tool of mental noting, or at least at times use it, pay attention, you know, to the tone in the mind. The second way of revealing to us what our relationship to the experience is, you know, whether there are filters of wanting or aversion or confusion, is something that was suggested by another Burmese Sayadaw teacher, Utejaniya. And this is found to be a very useful suggestion. He suggested asking frequently in the course of our meditation, just asking the question, what's the attitude in the mind right now? And we can do that with anything. We can do it with the breath. We could do it with sensations, with thoughts, with emotions. Well, what's the attitude? And very often, just by asking the question, something is revealed. So I'll give you just another example from my own practice. After I had heard this suggestion, I was sitting, very ordinary sitting. I was just feeling the breath, you know, in and out and in and out. And I thought I was being just present and mindful. But then I thought to ask the question. Oh, so just in the feeling of the breath, I asked myself, well, what's the attitude in my mind? It was so interesting, because simply by asking the question, not even getting an answer, simply by asking the question, I could feel my mind drop back from a wanting that I didn't even know was there. So I'm just feeling the breath, you know, in and out and in and out. What's the attitude? And it dropped back from this very subtle wanting of wanting more calm, or being with the breath for more concentration, or it was wanting something. And just by asking the question, the mind dropped back into what was really mindfulness, just there in the moment, with the experience, without any reactivity, you know, genuine acceptance of just the moment. So this points to one of the most fundamental understandings of meditation practice, and one which is easily forgotten. And that is, in terms of the meditation, it's really not important what it is that's arising. What's important is how we're relating to what's arising. So that's the key element, and that's the key element of mindfulness. How are we relating to whatever our present moment experience is. Be very helpful to keep this in mind. And the essence of this suggestion, I think, was captured by Ajahn Sumedho. You know, he was an American monk, a disciple of Ajahn Chah, very senior, senior monk. He had a great phrase. Our practice is not about following the heart, it's about training the heart. And I think that that is really very apt advice, because not everything in our hearts are wonderful. You know, many things are, but we're all a mix of a lot of different things. So it's not simply following every impulse of the heart, it's training the heart. And we train the heart through the power of mindfulness, of really seeing clearly, you know, what is skillful, what is unskillful, cultivating the one, letting go of the other. As we train our hearts through this practice, we really are much better able to navigate with clarity and with balance and with compassion, you know, all the immense challenges that are going on right now. So I feel it's just a really important connection between our meditation practice and living wisely and responding wisely to our present circumstances. So I'd like to close with just a very simple, I call it a metta prayer, prayer of loving kindness. Really simple, that I think everyone in any circumstance could easily cultivate, could easily see the value of. So may all beings everywhere be free of hatred. May all beings be free of enmity. And may all beings everywhere be at peace. Oh, thank you for your attention. And it was suggested that there was some time for questions and answers, but I prefer to characterize it as questions and responses, because whether the response will actually answer your question or not may be debatable, but there will be a response in any event.
Thank you so much, Joseph. It was wonderful listening to this talk. I looked at all the questions that we received, and I tried to look into the currents so that we can maybe try to answer a few of them and not just, you know, one by one. So I think there are two categories that would be very, very helpful to hear your thoughts and responses about. The first is, there are lots of questions about compassion. And I think a sense of kind of a dissolvement of the views surrounding compassion after what happened here on the 7th of October. So we've got quite a few questions about how to keep the practice and feeling and motivation of compassion with the events that have happened. So there are questions about how can I feel compassion towards Hamas. We've had, I'm sorry that we're bringing up all of that, but I think that even saying these things is helpful, just to have it here as a group of practitioners together. So how can I feel compassion towards Hamas? There was one very touching question. Since some of the people that were killed in Israel on the 7th of October were practitioners and peace activists. There was a question about how can I believe that if I am compassionate, then the other will respond to me in a way that is compassionate as well. So there was all, I think, that kind of deep questioning of the effect of our practice on the world. Is there an effect? So yeah, so that's one category. And then there's I'll just say the other one,
okay.
And then you can choose. Maybe you will just decide. The other category is questions about mindfulness that come from people working with people that were evacuated, people that were hurt, people in trauma. And there was one, I think, very important question from Amos Avisal, which is a teacher. And he asked for your advice regarding practices that are recommended in situations like this. What would you recommend if you're teaching a group of people that you know have been through immense trauma? So these are the two categories that I think about, and you can respond to whatever you feel is right.
Yeah, I mean, the current situation really gives rise to, you know, some very profound questions. So to address some aspects of the first category, for the purpose of the discussion, I would just like to kind of merge the feelings, the feeling of metta and compassion, because it's they both create a certain kind of response. And I'll share a story with you, which made me first think about all this very question. I was teaching a retreat just after 9/11, which, you know, was the American equivalent of October 7th, you know, when the planes flew into the World Trade Center and, you know, thousands of people were killed. And so I was teaching this retreat just after, and there were a lot of people from New York on the retreat. And we were teaching the metta, the loving kindness meditation. As many of you know, this general sequence in doing the loving kindness meditation. You start with a benefactor, and then a friend, and then a neutral person, and then what's called the enemy, and then all beings. So when we got to that category of sending metta to the enemy, right, in this case, the people who flew into the towers, many people, there is no way that I can have the wish, may you be happy. You know, that was just not even a possibility for people who had just suffered, you know, in that situation. So it really made me think in terms of the Buddhist teachings of these qualities being universal and boundless. What does it mean in that situation? What actually are we expressing? You know, is possible for us to express in that situation? And that's when I realized that it's really important not to be either formulaic about our practice of either metta or compassion, and also to enlarge our just the possibilities. So for me, that's when I realized, yeah, there is a way to express metta and compassion. And it's really what I ended the talk with. When I changed the language from may you be happy, you know, may you be well, to may you be free of hatred, may you be free of enmity. Is there anyone we would exclude from that? I mean, even with Hamas, to express the wish, may you be free of hatred, may you be free of enmity. Would we want to exclude the people who have perpetrated, you know, such violence? No, because those are the mind states, precise mind states that are the cause of those actions. So I think there is a way of being inclusive in our wish. And we may not want to, perhaps we may not even want to call it a loving wish, but it is, you know, if really that's what we're wishing for. You know, may you be free of enmity, may you be free of hatred. So I think there is a way when we craft the appropriate language and meaning to the situation, I think it is possible for it to be universal. And so I would just invite you to experiment, whether it's those particular words or maybe finding, you know, your own expression of wishing for the causes to be there for peace. So for me, in that situation right after 9/11, it was a transformative moment of transformation in my understanding of what the practice of metta and compassion could include. You know, because before that I had been just doing the very formulaic, may you be happy, may you be well, and that clearly didn't work. But there was a way that did work. And so I think it's worthy of exploration. In terms of the second question, there has been a lot of work by certain teachers of applying mindfulness and how to work with mindfulness with trauma. I am not an expert in this, so I haven't studied that particular niche of, you know, the application of mindfulness, but there are some very good books about using mindfulness in working with trauma. So I would just suggest, rather than my saying something which I don't have much experience with, to go to some experts, you know, because there is a body of knowledge of applying mindfulness in those situations, and there could be some really useful suggestions.
Thank you. So I think our time is up, or do we have time for a few more? Uli or Joseph?
I think we have time for one or two.
I have time.
Okay, wonderful. So I think I'll read one, okay, that touched my heart. So I think it's a common experience. And that's Amy Siegel, I think. What can I do when I feel my heart hardening and feel overwhelmed in fear, sadness, and anger? I cannot find within myself forgiveness, understanding, or compassion, or a feeling that all human life is precious. So that's to you.
So this touches on some deep issues. So just in a way, it's reiterating a bit of what I said about my working with fear. You know, so I think the first step is really parsing out those different emotions that were indicated, and really seeing what is the relationship we have in our experience of them. So this is a kind of a very interesting meditative insight, is that when we have aversion to something, it is actually feeding it, right? And so with very unpleasant emotions, in which aversion to them might seem natural because they're unpleasant and we want to get rid of them. But that attitude is exactly that attitude I described in my relationship to fear. I wanted to get rid of it. And that was locking it in. And so when I could create, finally, it took quite a while, just that spaciousness of mind that allowed it to be there. Because everything in its nature is impermanent. You know, we may feel that these emotions are lodged in us and are part of us and who we are, but it's not that. Emotions, even powerfully strong, unpleasant emotions, are like clouds in the sky, dark, threatening clouds, you know. If we can settle back and simply open to the feeling of them with that sense of spaciousness, I think there would be the experience of, at least in those moments, of them passing through and remembering the impermanent nature of whatever arises, so we don't create an image of ourselves as being a certain way. You know, before, in the years when I had just been working with the fear, before I had that kind of understanding, I remember creating, just having all kinds of thoughts, I'm such a fearful person. And, you know, it's going to take me 30 years of therapy to unwind this. And just, I was building a superstructure of self on top of what was really a passing emotion, sometimes there, sometimes not there. So I think it's important not to strengthen the belief that these emotions define you. They're arising out of certain patterns of conditioning. They have their causes behind it, but they arise and pass away. So if we, and they may come back again, I'm not saying they pass away forever, but it's a process. It's not who we are. And so if we can begin to practice not identifying so much with the emotion, but seeing it as an arising in the mind, or in the heart, and we feel it, and it's unpleasant, and that's what makes it challenging. You know, we don't like the feeling, just like we don't like physical pain in the body. But it is possible to settle back. Okay, it's okay to feel the unpleasantness. And in that acceptance, it opens up, or it unblocks the dam, you know, and so the emotions can flow more freely. So that's one aspect. On another level, and of course, I don't know the person who asked the question, so I don't know the background or whatever, but in general, when there are deep psychological, emotional patterns in which we do feel stuck, and even as we're trying to practice with mindfulness, some of the ways I suggested, sometimes other kinds of modalities are really helpful. So for example, sometimes therapy is really helpful in beginning to just disentangle a little bit, you know, the stuck quality of our minds in different emotions. So I would just explore different modalities also as a way of trying to free up all that energy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think what just one last, yeah. one last. This clearly is a huge. That question is a huge question, you know, and how to work with these very deeply powerful feelings. But one understanding to have, even if it's we begin with on the conceptual level, but more and more we can begin to taste it in our meditation practice. How to say? To use a phrase that doesn't come up so much in these Theravada teachings, but they're implied in them. And that's the term Buddha nature, right? And I think there's something powerful about understanding that we all have Buddha nature, which means that in all of us, the very nature of our minds, the very nature of awareness, it contains the potential, the possibility of freedom. It's already in there, right? And so over time, we learn to trust it. So that even as we're working with sometimes huge challenges of what's arising in the heart and mind, knowing that the Buddha was pointing to that space within ourselves where we can be relating to whatever it is in a free way. And that, of course, takes practice and perseverance. But to know that it's already here and we just have to uncover it. Yeah, so I hope at least maybe some things which I mentioned might be of some help.
Thank you. I was thinking while listening to you and reading these questions that even asking the question of how to be compassionate during war is a sign for me, while reading it at least, of great hope that there can be this type of question in the mind.
Yes.
While feeling threatened, while feeling, you know, all of these emotions, and that in itself, maybe even just the question itself, is quite an answer or a response
yeah.
to the situation. Yeah.
No, I think that's a very important observation. That it just reveals that we hold that as a value, even if we can't quite figure out exactly how to express it, but the fact that this is a core value in our lives just is so important.
Yeah, inspiring.
Yeah.
So there were more, if you're up to it.
Well, maybe one more.
Maybe one more. So there was a question about anger, and it's still in the realm of emotions, but also the question was about the power of anger to push me into certain views and actions. So if I would look at it as a simple question, maybe, then it was how to deal with states of anger, strong states of anger. Yeah.
So anger is a very interesting emotion, because very often it arises in response to a situation that needs addressing. So for example, anger could arise, not always, but sometimes it arises in the face of injustice. you know, or in the face of somebody being aggressive in one way or another. There are a lot of situations where anger is that first response to something going on that is not right, right? And we try to respond to it with anger as a way of pushing back. The problem, so in that way, the arising of anger can contain a useful message. It's saying, something is not right here. But it's not a useful emotion for effective response. So again, I'll share another story with you. Years ago, but over many years, so for about 10 years, I was teaching retreats at this wilderness facility in New Mexico for environmental and social activists. And these were people who were in the front lines of social action and environmental action. And the most common theme in the course of the retreat of the challenges that people had in the work they were doing was burnout. You know, because they were right in that frontline action of trying to affect change, and they were getting burned out by doing it. And in talking with them and, you know, exploring what this was about, it became pretty clear that the burnout was happening because they were using the energy of the anger to affect change. And the anger is not, it's a burning, it's not sustainable. The anger as an emotion burns us up. So even though its arising can be a really useful signal to us that something needs to be done, that we need to take some action, we need to respond, that's when, and this takes some real understanding and practice, to move from anger as the motivation for what we do. So in that case, for example, to transform it into compassion for the suffering that the environmental degradation was causing, or that the social oppression was causing, and let the compassion for that suffering be the motivating energy for the work, because that is sustainable and it's actually uplifting. One of the problems is that anger is a very seductive emotion, because generally when we feel angry, we're very energized, we feel strong, we feel empowered, right? And sometimes self-righteous, you know, in our feelings. So it's very seductive. But the Buddha had a beautiful image for anger and its various components. He said, anger with its poisoned root and honeyed tip, right? It does have that sweet tip that seduces us. But when we really look down to the root, it's not a wholesome state, you know, and it does burn us up. And in English, anyway, I don't know what the Hebrew would be, but in English we say somebody is burning with anger, you know, because it really does reflect what's happening in our energy system. So I think this is definitely worth exploring. And again, using that first hit of it as a good message for us. Oh, a response here is needed, but then not continuing with that energy in terms of how we respond and what we do. So this takes a lot of awareness and a lot of clarity and a lot of understanding.
Thank you. So I think we'll Say good night, and thank you so much or for you, it's a good morning, good afternoon. Thank you so much for your presence and wisdom and for sharing your experiences with us. I really feel, I think the community of practitioners in Israel feels great support when people like you agree, come and speak with us and kind of reflect about the experiences we're all going through. So thank you so much. And also again, Uri, maybe you want to say good night, but thank you for translating this wonderful book. And for Karen, again, which is not feeling well, we wish you good health. And yeah, so good night, Uli.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Joseph, so much for this evening.
Well, it was really wonderful to be with you all and share a lot of good wishes for peace.
Lילה טוב ושקט לכולם.
Hello.